My heart is so heavy right now for Houston and everything that's taken place with the flooding and all the things that the folks are going through that live there and are affected by this. I'm so sorry this is happening. Please know that my thoughts, my prayers are with you. And I know all of us listening, all the defenders listening, feel the same way. I've had my basement, I've had it flooded in the past, and that was a nightmare enough. I can't imagine trying to keep your head above water in your house, and I'm so sorry that's happening. I just really wanted to start this episode off this way because Matt and I do talk about how sad the world can be, and this was recorded a while before these unfortunate and tragic events. But I felt like I just wanted to start the show addressing that and telling you, Houston, that we're with you, and please fight on. This episode is brought to you by Adobe. Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for designing, sharing, and prototyping experiences. Try the free beta today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 41. Today, I got to interview designer, studio founder, letterpress connoisseur, and now filmmaker, Matt Griffin. We dive deep into design, carousels, how awful the world is, and how good that is for us. Tom York, cycle pants, sorry, cyclers, and so much more. Please enjoy my deep yet hilarious interview with Matt Griffin. I want to share an iTunes review that came through recently. This one was from Buzz Udit, all the way from India. And the title of the review is absolutely inspiring. 5 stars. I have recently started listening to this podcast and I'm absolutely hooked. The episodes are getting better and better. Absolutely love the concept of UX superheroes. Thanks so much for leaving that wonderful review, Buzz Udit. I know that's not your name, but thanks for leaving it and encouraging me. I'm so glad to hear that you like the theme of the show. And I'm thrilled, especially that it's keeping you inspired and that it's getting better. That's good. That's the goal. I want to see a trajectory of growth, and it's great to kind of get that validation from you on that. So thanks so much. Defenders listening, would you mind leaving a rating and review? It helps the show a ton to get in front of new listeners and designers like yourself trying to stay inspired like Buzz Udit. I would be so grateful if you'd do that. You can do so real easily by going to userdefenders.com/review. Thanks so much in advance. Matt Griffin is a designer and founder of Bearded and Woodtype Revival, and the director of What Comes Next is the Future, a documentary film about the web. He's a speaker, writer, and an avid advocate for collaboration in design. He's also a letterpress printer and one of the creators of Woodtype Revival, a project which seeks out lost historic woodtype and converts it into digital fonts for modern designers. Matt lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with his wife Elizabeth and his son Argus. Previous to entering the world of design, Matt was an active musician, drums mostly. He toured all over the world and played in a fair number of records, and his band got pretty famous in Japan. Matt, welcome to User Defenders. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
And thanks for letting me wrestle with the alliteration in your bio there.
No problem.
A little tongue-tied there. But your band got famous in Japan. I love that. It reminds me of Hasselhoff. He got pretty famous in Germany.
Big in Germany.
Oh, yeah. They love him.
I mean, we were no Hasselhoff, but, you try.
Have you ever seen any of his videos on YouTube?
Oh, yes.
I have no words.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
I want to say splendid. Is that...
The Splendid Hasselhoff.
.com.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
So every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments just to give us a look into your personal life.
Oh, sure. So as you said, I'm married to my wife, Elizabeth, for the last 10 years. And I have a son, Argus, who's a 7-year-old. And so we spend a heck of a lot of time together. That's most of my personal life. I like biking a lot, so I bike to work whenever I can and anywhere else that works. But I'm not one of those like fancy bikers with the outfit and stuff. I plug away like a marginal human being on my bicycle to get places.
What is it about the tights?
I think
the tight pants.
They're actually like, I mean, I think I'm the jerk for not wearing the tight pants because it's more of like I just can't bring myself to wear that outfit, or any outfit like that.
Yeah.
But I found actually after years of doing, this is going to get, you said personal, so here we go. I've worn through a lot of jeans over the years, and it's always in the same place. And I'll just leave it at that. And it took me years to realize that it was biking all the time in jeans. It was like wearing out the seat of my pants. And then I was like, that's why they wear biking outfits, I think.
That makes sense.
I went and got what are called commuter pants, which look a little closer to normal pants. Like, they're pretty normal. They just like dorky normal pants, but they're made of special non wearable in the worn sense fabric. So I don't have holes in my pants anymore, thanks to that, as the short version.
Biking saved my pants.
Yeah.
There's your next blog title there.
I think there's also like a whole sweating, chafing element to it comes into play. So like, it's actually probably a really smart thing to do. I'm just, I can't do that. There's something in my Andy Rocks jeans that won't let me wear that outfit.
Yeah. And bikers, I apologize for, my,
you're all fine.
My assumption,
great.
They're great. You guys,
there's nothing wrong with
that. I'm going to get some feedback on that, I think.
Half of my Twitter followers go away.
No, but you know what? I understand totally. It's a lack of empathy on my part, and I apologize.
Me too. Okay. Oh, too.
So tell us your origin story, Matt. What inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field?
Oh, my goodness. So I came pretty late to design, I guess, as compared to anyone that came straight out of school. So I'm 39 years old, and I came to the web somewhat early, not like 80s early, not like Chris Wilson early, but I came to the web early-ish. And in the mid-90s, I went to college, and like 95, I started school, college school, not first grade. That would be pretty weird. So I started like higher education in 95, and I got my first email address to like yay Telnet and started messing around on the early web. I had a GeoCities account, which is where I learned HTML. I was on Sunset Strip, for those of you who remember. That was where music people were, and I have no idea what I did with that account. I really don't remember. Wrote about bands and stuff, probably. And I made my bands. I played in indie rock bands, and I played the drums a lot. And I made my bands websites. I figured out how to make the web to make my bands websites when I was in college. And I actually went to school for audio recording at Indiana University in Bloomington, the School of Music there. And I did about 3.5 years of that. And then dropped out right at the end because I realized that if I was in audio, I'd have to record bands that I don't like mostly and try to make them sound good, which sounded like my idea of hell. So I dropped out of school right at the end before I graduated, which made my parents very proud. And then I moved to Chicago, as one does when you're undereducated and have no job prospects. And I went with my band, and I worked at a record store. I worked at Reckless Records in Wicker Park, if anybody knows that, the snootiest of record stores, and played my band. We somehow did get famous in Japan. Long story, but it's not bad, so I'll give it a shot.
All right.
The band, before I joined the band, they had one CD, and a used copy of that CD ended up at a record store in Tokyo. And the one person that bought that one CD happened to work for a record label called Trattoria Records, which is a subsidiary of Polystar Records, which is like a gigantic record label, right?
Oh, yeah.
Trattoria is like a little cottage labeled that was run by someone who, this guy Cornelius, that was on Matador in the U.S. and on Polystar when he was younger in Japan and had gone like platinum or whatever. So they just, he finished his band, his platinum-y band, and then they said, what do you want? He was like, I want my own record label. So then he just started putting out weird records in Japan on this record label, but with like major label funding. So the guy who bought the CD of ours was the drummer from his band and now like an A&R guy, but like not a real A&R. Just like the guy in the band that got famous, right? They're basically just playing around at being a label. So he signs us. We're one of his favorite records of the year. And we ended up going to Tokyo and playing on Japanese television live and like doing magazine interviews and playing. We played a big show in Tokyo and like we got to be some of it, like a little bit famous in Japan. Doing that. My sister-in-law's Japanese, actually, and she was in Tokyo a few years later and said she was at a restaurant and saw our video come on TV, so that's kind of exciting. But because it's Japan, like, I actually didn't experience most of it firsthand, and it's hard to know what, like, you know, even the reviews I had to have translated, and Japanese is very different than English, so a lot of it, I had people tell me, like, I actually can't translate, I don't know how to say this in English, it's very poetic, so it's very difficult to explain what it means, but it's good, which maybe they were just telling me because they didn't want to tell me all the horrible things the review said, but I don't know, it was a weird time. Let me tell you, to be 22.
Yeah, well, it's hard to really be successful in music. I mean, it's incredibly hard.
And yeah, some would say impossible.
Right, yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it's funny, like, this is, and music is one area where less gatekeepers has not really helped that much.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody can make a CD on GarageBand now, on their Mac. Everyone.
Yeah. It turns out that, like, being financially successful in music is not usually feasible. And I think something that really changed my mind about that. So as I was doing all that playing in bands and being like, you get famous in Japan at 22, like famous in quotes in Japan at 22. And you're like, this is it. Like, it's only up from here. Right. Thank goodness I dropped out of school. It often doesn't work that way. And then we came back to the US and played to 20 people at shows or whatever, for, you know, $20 if we were lucky. And it got sad real fast. And I played in other bands and bands that did better than that in Europe and whatever. So I got to do a lot of touring and making records for like the next 10 years, basically, or maybe 5 years, I guess, out of school. And then decided to go back to school because I needed a real job. And part of the thing that really convinced me was I was getting older and needed healthcare, which seemed like a good idea. Pertinent subject at the moment. By the way, healthcare is good.
And survival is not a soft skill.
Yeah,
right? True. That's a Mike Montero quote.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Staying alive, I think is how he put it.
I can quote my 7-year-old son by when I tried to explain that right now, if you have money, you can, doctors will treat you when you're sick. And if you don't, if you're poor, then you don't get a doctor when you're sick. He was like, that doesn't make any sense. So, you know, 7-year-olds, they get it. But, so anyway, I needed healthcare and need a real job. And what I started to realize too, is a lot of those like small bands that like indie bands, are connected with financial support in some way, like trust funds and things like that. So like, they don't have to be successful and that's why they can get away with that. And, you know, no judgment, like people have their legacies, but if you don't have that and it appears to be that it can be financially feasible, then that's really confusing. You wonder, like, what am I doing wrong that I can't figure out how to make this work? And the answer is, well, your granddaddy wasn't a executive at Jack Daniels or whatever, so you don't get checks every month.
John Daniels. John, when you've known him as long as I have.
Jonathan, yeah. old Jonathan Daniels.
Oh, yeah.
So anyhow, at some point I decided I was going to go back to school, and I'd been making all these websites and posters and things like that for my bands. And I looked into the graphic design program at Indiana University, which is where I was living again. I was back in Bloomington. And it turns out that because I dropped out of school in the 90s, when I tried to go back to school in 2004, 2005, I was able to just re-enroll And they backdated me to my 19, at that point I transferred in 96, and my 1996 rates for IU, which is much better than 2004 rates, let me tell you. And also, I'd been living in Indiana so long that they made me in-state. So I had 96 in-state rates. So I think I went back to school for like $5,000 a year or something at that point. Hmm. And as soon as I figured out that scam, I was like, going back to school for something. So I went for design, which seemed like it would be creative in the way music was, but yeah. Had jobs in the way that music didn't. Mm. And that worked out pretty well. After that, I got my, I decided to move back to Pittsburgh, where I'm from. I'd met my wife, Elizabeth, then, and we decided to be like, Pittsburgh, I'm going to give it a shot. I found out about my first real design job as we were driving into Pittsburgh in a U-Haul. So it wasn't like a good plan that we had. It was like I'd applied to jobs and then we just moved and hoped we could find one. I don't necessarily recommend that. But I got the job. It went okay in that I did work, but I didn't really get along with any of my four bosses that well, some more than others. It was seven people, four of them were my boss, which, you know, should indicate something to you. Mm. But I learned a lot about just how to be in a job. I also learned that I wasn't super happy in that situation. I wasn't sure if it was working for other people in general or just those people. And then I got offered some adjunct teaching at Carnegie Mellon University, which is here in Pittsburgh, doing some design teaching, starting with just a production class. The person who had been teaching it had to go on maternity leave, and they needed somebody last minute to take the class. And Liz had already gotten teaching there in photo, so it was sort of like knowing people that knew people. And they said, hey, doesn't your husband, isn't he a designer? Would he teach this class? And I did. So that was my foot in the door there. At the same time, an old high school friend asked me if I wanted to leave and do web work with him. He was a developer and was doing his own design at the time. He said he had too many clients and needed a full-time designer, and asked if I would work for him. And I said, absolutely not. I won't work for you. But I was thinking of going freelance anyway on my own. So I think maybe I'll just do that. And he said, well, maybe... Well, how about instead of working for me, we just start a new thing and make it 50-50 and start our own studio? And so we did that. And that's how Bearded started. And I ended up doing that for, it's been almost 9 years. Wow. That we've been doing that. Now actually, we're stopping. So, we haven't announced that yet.
What?
Yeah.
Right. Do I sound surprised?
That was feigned surprise. I told you in advance. But yeah, we decided to shut down, Bearded partly, for a number of reasons we can get into, if you want, but
yeah, I definitely want to hear the story because you've invested a lot, of time, blood, sweat, and tears into Bearded, and, you guys have become like a real premier studio out there too.
Thanks.
Very renowned, and you guys have done some amazing work. And, so when you told me this, last week, and we were catching up, for this time, I was both, shocked, but also excited for you.
Thanks.
But yeah, absolutely. And can you tell us a story of kind of what's transpired? And this is sort of a User Defenders exclusive, I think.
Yeah, other than some close friends. Yeah. And obviously everyone I work with, clients and things. So sure. Yeah, pretty high up the list. So I've been doing Bearded for almost 9 years. We started in November 2008. Mm. And so maybe 8.5 years, something like that. When we started, it was just me and Michael started the business together, and who's the developer I spoke about earlier. And we worked, the two of us, and then we hired this guy, Dominic DeGrotti, that I just adore. We hired him before he was even done at CMU. He was a CS major at CMU. And he worked with us for about 3 years, and then he went off to Heroku and is now at Chain in San Francisco, which is like a blockchain development place. So really, right out of the gate, pretty talented people. Then we hired Matt Braun, and who's still with us now. He's a partner now, and Brett Bender, his developer, is with us now. And then lots of other people. And we grew over the years, becoming, at our largest, I think, 9 or 10 people. But we tended to average around, like, 5, 6, 7, something like that. And we've been doing it for a long time. We've done a bunch of different side projects. We did Woodtype Revival early on, which was great. And that was the first thing we did, I think, that really got us known in the design industry. which is, if you don't know about it, is a Kickstarter project to buy a bunch of letterpress wood type stuff, which is Matt Braun and I both do letterpress printing, and lost old typefaces, wood typefaces, and then print them, scan them, outline them, and kern the hell out of them until we had workable digital fonts to give back to the people who gave us the money to buy the type. So that was wood type revival. We made apps here and there, none of which that ever got big. And then I did the movie recently, What Comes Next is the Future, which is at futureisnext.com. It's a documentary about the web, and I spent about 3 years doing that. Mm. And I think when that ended, it took a while to occur to me, but it kind of felt like, you know, now what? Like, at first I was just like, oh, I'm so glad it's over. It's been so hard doing this. It was such a lot of work while at the same time trying to run an agency. And I think it took a long time to dawn on me that I had been tackling a very unusual project for a web agency, making a movie, in part because I was becoming a little bored with what we were doing and looking for something interesting and an interesting new challenge. And I certainly found it. That kept me busy for a few years, too busy most of the time. And when it was over, it felt like this vacuum, like now I'm just back to doing what I've already done. I also think that we never grew really big, and that was a conscious decision. I like the culture of a smaller place. I didn't want to turn into, like, I don't know, a businessman. with all of the ridiculous connotations that involves. It just didn't feel right to me, so I kept it small.
No swoopovers.
Yeah. So it's, you know, like that, I think that was good culturally, but then the problem with a small agency is you run out of roles, you run out of things you can do, and once you've mastered everything there is to be done, there's nowhere else to move. Like, I can't move to another department or be promoted, right? And that's true for everyone at Bearded, pretty much. There wasn't, like, another spot to move to. So I think that became frustrating. But none of that really came to a head because I just sort of assumed, well, I do this forever. This is my thing. Other people come and go, but this is, you know, I do this. This is what I do. And then an offer came along. I'd been speaking with people at Shopify for a while. It was an e-commerce platform in Canada that you may or may not be aware of. And we were talking about doing some contracting work, and that ended up falling through for various reasons. But then the guy I was talking to said, honestly, what I'm really interested in is seeing if you wanted to come here. We really like your work. We were hoping to try you out with a project, but if you're interested in talking about this, if you're open to something new, we could talk. And at the time I said, no, I'm not. I wasn't ready for that concept yet. And then my family went to Australia and New Zealand. I was speaking at Web Directions, John Alsop's conference in Sydney, which was amazing.
Oh, wow.
He brought me and my family there, and then we had 2 weeks of vacation in New Zealand. And right during the conference, when I was presenting I gave a talk and I was presenting the film. And the night I had to present the film was the night of the U.S. presidential election. And despite all of my assumptions about the prevailing sanity of human beings, Donald Trump was elected. And that really threw me for a loop. I think it's a terrible thing. I'm not going to hide any of my political feelings. I think Trump is a terrible man, and he does terrible things to lots of people, and he represents a lot of things that I think are despicable about human beings, and unfortunately are more prevalent than I'd like. We all have nasty things in us. Trump just lets them all out unapologetically. And when he was elected, I felt terrible about the whole thing, and I had to get up in front of a room full of Australians and talk about a movie. Really, like, minutes after it being confirmed that Hillary dropped out of the race. So anyway, I had to give up, and I gave sort of an impromptu little speech saying that this is awful as far as I'm concerned, and I don't know what to do about it yet, but the good news is I made this movie, and it's a happy movie, so we get to watch that for an hour and feel good about ourselves and what we do every day at work. So we did that. And then spent 2 weeks, my wife and son and I, running around New Zealand, half pretending that nothing had gone wrong and half fantasizing about moving to New Zealand and living a different life far away from the U.S. And I think that weird, though that never happened, and it's just impractical to move to New Zealand for a bunch of reasons. It's on the other side of the world, and they have earthquakes all the time, and they're on this tiny strip of land in the middle of the ocean. Those things don't go together very well.
Yeah, but Lord of the Rings was filmed there.
It's unbelievable. On. It's gorgeous, and I love it. And I kind of want to move there anyway someday. Like, I'll put up with the earthquake. But I have a young kid, and my parents and Liz's parents would be never see him, and that's not cool. So
yeah, sure.
And jobs were a bit of an issue, too. Like, I couldn't find anything that was, like, exciting, you know. Australia is great for jobs, but mm-hmm. New Zealand feels right to me. Anyhow, didn't go to New Zealand, but we came back sort of feeling like, ugh, like that was a missed opportunity. Maybe we should be doing something like that. Maybe we should be changing our lives. Maybe we should be trying something different, and maybe leaving the country isn't so bad. And then Shopify got back in touch and said, hey, how you doing? I said, great, except, you know, all of politics. And they said, well, maybe you should, you know, you could come and take a break and come to Canada if you want, if you're still into it. And again, I was going to say, no, I can't imagine doing that, like shutting down my business, moving to another country. It's so much work and so much change. I just can't get my head around it. And then it was my wife who said, maybe you should talk to them. Just find out what they have to say. Mm-hmm. You can't make a reasonable decision without knowing what's going on and what they're offering. So I said, okay, like, let's do it. And we started talking, and they brought me out there, and I had a couple of days of interviews and talking with people and trying to understand what it was I'd be doing, what this new life would be, and wandering around Ottawa and seeing if we liked the city. And the more we talked about it and the more we found out, the more attractive it started to sound. And of course, they made a good offer. And more than that, it was just the description of the work I'd be doing, and the job was really compelling. It would be the idea that I would be in a product company for the first time in my life. I'd have all these new things to learn. I'd have new skills to develop. I'd be in a much larger company. There are almost 2,000 people.
Very stable company.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten used to the instability. So, you know, the roller coaster is whatever. It's, I mean, honestly, it's like at this point, you either get an ulcer and quit, or you just kind of create this lie in your mind that everything's fine so that you can exist every day. And I did the latter. I just I pretend that I'm not in danger of going out of business ever. So I'm okay with that. I mean, my feeling is, like, you work at a big company, you can get fired any day, or they could do layoffs any day, right? Like,
sure.
So it's all a lie. Security's a lie. But
that's, you know what? That's true.
But, you know, I figured you can move around. You can do the thing that I had a problem with at my own company at Bearded, which is, there were other things to do. If I get bored with something, I can move to another department. I could learn new skills. I could move up. I could move sideways, whatever. That's all fine. So that was what became really compelling. And then the feeling that everything I've done, I guess my initial feeling that I didn't want to do it was, if I stop doing Bearded, then it's all for nothing. I'm throwing all that work away. You know, that invalidates everything I've done up to this point. And it took me a while to realize that that's not true, that those good experiences and that good work and all of the building of that thing are still there and are still just as important as they were before. And what I take away with them is the sense that I'm better for it. I've learned, I've grown. All the people that worked on it learned and grew. All the clients we had learned and grew. So everyone took that with them as themselves, right? And then I can take that on to this new job. So all of that stuff does live on, but through the people who did it. And that really changed my attitude about it, that I can take all the stuff, go somewhere else, have new experiences, and maybe the worst outcome would be to keep doing Bearded, keep doing this thing I loved, but past the point where I loved it. And that was really a bigger danger to ruining the whole thing than just stopping.
Wow. Well, thanks for telling that story, Matt. I mean, there's a lot happening behind the scenes here, obviously, because it is such a big deal. It's such a big move, and it's hard to uproot your family, especially. I mean, not let alone in the United States where you're already a citizen, but let alone, I mean, but seriously, like, to another country where everything's completely different, and you have to really learn how all the nuances of things that you've grown so accustomed to here in the U.S. So that's a big deal.
Yeah, it's super weird. I mean, it's like right there, right? So you think, like, oh, it's like Ohio or whatever, like moving to Minnesota. Yeah. It's not. It's
no.
All the utilities are different. Like, the mobile providers are different. The ISPs are different. Like,
yeah.
the currency is different, and the currency exchange changes every minute. And like, it's crazy. Like retirement savings is different. Everything's different.
Yeah. Well, I commend you, brother, for your courage and and for being willing to step out of the comfort zone and also to put something that you've worked so hard to build on the altar. And I know that, you know, it's hard to kind of see the good in it right now, maybe even for some of your team.
Oh, I think that's much harder for them because they didn't make the decision, right? They're just reacting to my decision.
Right.
And I think that was part of the hard decision for me too, was can I do this to these other people? Mm. And I think what I finally realized is like, you know, all of our careers are our own responsibility.
Yeah.
And people leave, you know, like I've run this business and plenty of people have left the job.
Yeah.
And I didn't hate them for it.
Right.
That's like, okay, that's what they have to do right now in their career. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, that's what I did. And we had a talk with the partners and I said, look, this is what I need to do. If you guys want to keep doing this, I have some ideas about how you could do it. And I'm going to make it as easy as possible for you to do it. In terms of, you know, my ownership in the company and everything.
Yeah.
And they talked about it and ultimately decided they didn't want to keep doing it. It felt too much like starting over and they were going to take the opportunity to try new things too. They've both been doing it for, you know, 6 to 7 years.
Yeah.
And so that was the decision that everybody made ultimately. And that's okay.
Yeah. And it's hard to see the future. I mean, right. The reality is that so often it kind of takes a little bump for us to kind of do something even greater, right, than what we maybe even imagined ourselves doing. So it sometimes takes that. So I think that, you know, the challenge now will be a thank you later, I think. honestly, but you've built a great team, man. And I know that that's a testament to you and your leadership.
Well, it's a testament to them and their really hard work mostly, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I just try to provide an environment where people can do good work.
Yeah.
And I've been really lucky with people I hired. And I think that was the other thing that encouraged me was everybody that's worked at Bearded, I think it's been a way for them to prove themselves and then move on with that reputation better than when they came in. So it's not like I'm just, you know, throwing people in the sewer or something, right? Like,
they got
our stamp of approval, and I've worked really hard to find them places that they can apply and make contacts for them on their behalf, and certainly talk them up in any references. But you know, this is how things move on sometimes.
Indeed. Well, and sorry about this segue, because we're going to talk about failure, and I don't believe that.
I can talk about that though.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, this big step you're taking is not a failure. It's a big success, and for you and your family, and for your future, and all your people, as we just talked about. But I want to talk about before this. This is the part where we talk about life-altering experiences, and we get into your transformation. Can you tell us a story about what's been maybe the biggest failure in your career? I think it's sometimes a great way that we can all learn, and we've certainly learned from our own failure and our own mistakes the most, but I think we also can learn from others as well.
Absolutely. You know, the thing that felt the worst in my career was starting so late as a designer. The fact that I waited so long to go back to school for design. I got out of design school when I was about 30. And I had my first entry-level design job at 30. And I was making, you know, $30,000 a year. I joke that I made $1,000 a year for every year of my life. which, when you know that, like, there are 22-year-olds that are doing the same thing, feels pretty bad. And I'm like, how do I catch up on that 8-year gap? It felt like such wasted time. And I actually felt really resentful towards music and what I had done with music for that for a long time, for a few years. I really felt like I had screwed up by not taking a career seriously and trying to do this impossible thing with music. And what it finally led me to, though, was to quit that first job about a year and a half in and start my own company, because I'd been applying to jobs. No one would even call me back or email me or anything. And I realized that the only person that was going to value me the way that I required at that point was myself. I was the only person to take a risk on myself, right? So I started our own company. I was like, all right, I'm going to prove it. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to do what I think is good work, because no one else will let me do that, and see if that happens. And I mean, it worked out pretty well. It gave me the drive I needed to make up that lost time and work really hard. And for a while, kind of fake it and like pretend like I had more experience than I did. You know, I only had a year and a half of professional experience, and I was pitching projects to clients that I never heard of any or anyone else. And I had this weird name, you know, like who are these bearded people? And the only, I mean, I was lucky that I had some adjunct teaching at CMU, so I could say I taught at CMU, just be vague about it, right?
Because it looks good on the resume, man.
It does. It does. But adjunct doesn't usually, I mean, my wife has been adjunct professor for years. I think the adjunct position is incredibly exploitative for a number of reasons. But avoiding all of that issue, I think you put I teach at Carnegie Mellon University on there, and at least gives you some like, okay, well, he can't be a complete idiot. little do they know. But that helped. And then after we built up all that stuff, it sort of ultimately, I was able to realize that all that time playing in bands and what seemed sort of like screwing around was really formative for me to be able to do everything else that I do. And I think if you can learn how to take four very creative, very opinionated people with very few resources, no money, very little sleep, and who care about every little decision, and you can get consensus and actually like produce things and accomplish things in that situation, you can do anything. You can definitely run a design business. So that was really, really valuable experience. And building stakeholder consensus at a client organization now seems like nothing compared to like writing songs in a basement with three tired, very opinionated other people.
Yeah. Well, Matt, your story just made me think about some of our defenders listening. I mean, I've actually interfaced with some who are pushing 40, maybe even 50, and just now sort of realizing they're having that eureka moment, that aha moment, if you will, where they're saying, you know, this is something I really want to do. I'm tired of whatever, you know, in fill in the blank that I've been doing for the past, you know, 20 years or whatever, 30 years of my career. And certainly a very hard thing to pivot, you know, at later on in life, but it's happening. This is an exciting field to work in, obviously. And this, honestly, as you say, what comes next is the future. I mean, everything related to this comes next, right? I mean, this is the future.
Who the heck knows?
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, I can tell you this, it's going to involve technology. It's going to involve artificial intelligence. It's probably, whether you like it or not, involve virtual reality. The jury's out on that one for me still. But all that to say, what do you say to those folks, those defenders listening, those guys and gals that are like, you know, I want to do this. What do you say to those people who are like, I want to do it, but is it too late for me? Am I going to be able to catch up? Do I have to catch up, or what do I do here?
It's hard, isn't it? I mean, people have asked me things like, how did you get your first clients? And I can't even answer that because the guy I started with, he had some clients already. So that magic was already there. Like, how do you start from zero? I actually don't know.
Yeah.
It was close to zero. I mean, we had like one $5,000 website and a logo project. You know, it wasn't like we were like rolling in the work, but every little job we did helped make the next job. And I mean, I can tell you, geez, one of our first projects also was like my parents' company needed a website. So we made that, right? That stuff happens. Oh, yeah. But I think you start out and you take every damn opportunity you can get and make it work for you. And that, I know that's also a statement that comes from a position of relative privilege, that I'm a person who could afford to quit my steady job and take CMU teaching in an uncertain future and know that the worst thing that would happen is I'd move in at my parents' house, you know. So I certainly get that. I don't know. I don't know if I can give advice to people like that. It's a big risk, and it's very complicated. Can you make a move to a field like this at any point in your life? Maybe. I don't know. I also really am reluctant to go with that, like, follow your passion, you know, you're a shooting star kind of bullshit speech, because I also think that comes from a place of severe privilege, that if you care about it enough, you're going to make it. Bullshit. Absolutely not. That's not true at all. There are many factors that go into, quote unquote, making it, which maybe we could define as just like making enough money to survive. It's hard to do. And I think if...
Yeah.
Someone gave me good advice once. It was Irene Au when we were making the movie. And that was to look for the intersection of what you're good at what you love doing and what the world needs. And I think that third component is really crucial and people forget a lot. If there is no demand for that thing you are good at and love, it does not work. Like, I was really good at playing the drums, still pretty good, and I loved doing it, but there weren't enough people that wanted to hear the kind of music I wanted to make. Doesn't work. Doesn't matter how passionate you are. It's not going to work for you. And I think the thing that's been most successful for me is keeping an eye out for those opportunities as they present themselves and just trying to make the right choice of, I'm going to try this now. It's not about writing a 10-year business plan and then following it out because you know what the opportunities are going to be. It's about always keeping those feelers out for any opportunity, no matter how insignificant seeming, and following it. And if it doesn't work, you drop it and try and find that next one. And you just keep adjusting with what you have at your disposal until you claw your way up that hill to something that works, you know? Like, I wasn't just like, I want to move to Canada and I'm going to figure out how to do that. But that opportunity showed up, and after my wife convinced me to look at it, it did seem like the best option, even though it was scary and maybe painful. And I mean, she pointed out, this does not happen often. It is not often that something like this shows up on your doorstep, so you need to think really hard about it before you turn it away.
Yeah, that's great advice, Matt, and there's a lot of good nuggets in there to take away from. I was just thinking, too, about, you know, following your passion, and it's easy to say that. Certainly it's not, I think it's important to do what you love to do if you have the opportunity and you really work hard to obtain that. But I agree with you as far as following your passion. That's not always the best idea because I'm super passionate about coffee.
Yeah, right.
I love coffee. Coffee's super passionate. Great. I like to roast coffee at home, but I can't feed my family. I have a very large family. I cannot feed them with my coffee passion. So I am passionate about this work, and I've been able to do this, since 2000. So I'm grateful for that. But I like what Angela Duckworth says. I think it was her. She said it from the great book called Grit. She says, don't follow your passion. She said, foster your passion. And you keep looking, like you just said, keep looking for those opportunities and take them on. And even if it's something you're doing on the side, until you get that experience and build it up, and then that confidence that confidence happens too with every win you get, with every little project you succeed on.
Right.
You know, right? Build that confidence up, and then you can ask for more money if you're freelancing. You can not be embarrassed by it, even if you are. Maybe you should be a little embarrassed by what you're asking for in your contract, right? Because you could always come down a little bit too.
I've written a lot about this, like mechanics of making a design business work on a list of parts. So if you're thinking about starting your own studio, or you do run your own studio, feel free to go look at those articles. But one of them that I think is actually pretty meaningful to me is the one about being profitable. Because it took me a long time to feel comfortable with the idea of being profitable. That is charging more money than you absolutely require.
Yeah.
And what I realized after years of not being profitable than just scraping by was that is untenable. You're just waiting for the moment when you go out of business. That if you have just enough money to pay the next month, you're going to fail eventually, because there's going to be some month where that project doesn't come through. And we were project to project to project forever, partly because I felt embarrassed about, quote unquote, overvaluing myself. And then I realized that profit is an essential part of the padding of running a business, that there will
That's
be
right.
lean times and there will be, good times. And you need to prepare for both of those. So, you got to build in all the time you spend and more. You have to make more money than it costs you to do the work.
That's right. Yeah, I said business equals revenue greater than expenses. That's the bottom line.
Yep.
And you do have to make your business work that way.
Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for creating beautiful, interactive user experiences for websites and desktop or mobile apps. Adobe XD helps you design, prototype, and even share your experiences with your teammates and stakeholders for feedback. Try the free beta for Mac or Windows today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more.
that first time we had 3 or 4 months sitting in a bank account, that's when my horrible anxiety about the business started to go away. Mm. That waking up in the middle of the night in sweats and counting down your invoices to the last penny, you know, and timing of every check when it was going to arrive. That's miserable. And you can't do good work that way.
Right, exactly.
So figuring out how to have that padding is absolutely essential.
That's great stuff. Matt, so in your years of running Bearded, I know you guys have done user testing, and I'm curious, have you ever had anything really crazy or super awkward happen during those sessions?
I haven't really. Nothing totally nuts. We had a fun one recently. I'm sure this people have seen this or heard this, but we were doing usability testing for a college website. We had to use exclusively college students, and particularly we were looking at admissions, so we were only using like 18 or 19 year olds, right? So high school seniors, college freshmen. And this one kid, who I think was a graduating high school senior, finished the thing, and he had been pretty critical about the site design he was looking at. At the end, he started talking to someone in the next room, and he was saying like, "Oh man, I totally ragged on that website. Man, I was brutal on them. I can't believe they paid me $75 for this," and just started kind of going off on it. And I wasn't on the call. I wish I had been, because I really would have messed with him. But they just like ended the phone call. And I was like, man, guys, why didn't you? There's so many things you could do with that. One is just to wait for a moment of silence and say, hey, buddy, we're still on the call here. So about that $75, you could do that. And just,
we haven't signed that check yet, buddy.
Yeah, just because, you know, it's funny. You would do it. Of course, you'd pay him. But it's like, it's good. That's a good lesson for a young person to learn about what you say while you have a video camera and a microphone in front of you. It's like the making the rude comment about a client into Slack while you're screen sharing or something. Oh, I've never done that, but I've seen it happen.
What a nightmare.
And you're like, what are you doing? Like, this is why you don't make those comments into Slack. Just don't do it. Like, don't. Yeah. It's never worth it.
Right.
You know? So, like, that was funny. I had a client, this isn't user testing, but I once had a client referred to breadcrumbs as cookie crumbs, and I just think that's adorable and wish we would call them that all the time. It's just great.
Then you'd have to rename cookies.
They could be breads, I guess. We'll just switch them.
Yeah, cookie crisps.
Your browser breads. No, it's terrible. Doesn't work.
Atkins trails. Okay.
Carbs,
what's your design superpower, Matt?
My design superpower is to listen to what people are saying and asking for, then figure out what their actual real needs are, unearth their misconceptions about the situation, and then help them build consensus about what decisions need to be made and what they need to do next.
Dang, that's a mission statement right there.
Pretty
you just gave us a mission statement. That was very, very articulated, Matt.
Thanks. That's most of my job is doing that thing. I really like having a room full of people who are confused about how they should proceed and what they need to do, or have harmful misconceptions, you know, things that they're stuck to, ideas that are not in their own self-interest and do not support their own goals. I love walking in that room and listening to them and working with them and helping them to go down that path of realizing what will actually help them and what they actually need to do. It's so satisfying at the end of the day.
Mm. And I know that you mean that, because you didn't even have to think about that answer and it came out so, so clear.
I
love it. Adversely, what's your design kryptonite?
My design kryptonite, carousels, I guess. they just put me in a bad mood. You know?
Why do we still use them? Why do we still do it?
Because they solve a very real internal stakeholder issue of everyone wants everything on the top of the homepage. They're perfect.
That's
for
true.
That. But it offloads a client, an internal organizational problem, onto a user experience, which is awful. It's absolutely awful, right? Not only is it not giving the user what you think you're giving them, but then they pay a performance hit problem. And if they're on a cellular network and have limited data, then you just really screwed up their mobile plan, right? Well, for no reason, for something they won't look at, which is super sad. So I think instead people need to figure out how to talk to each other and prioritize and understand from the user's perspective what users need, rather than just shoving all their crap in a carousel.
So good, man. Yeah, and it doesn't matter how much data you show the stakeholders, they're still going to want a carousel.
Hey, sometimes it does. No, I give basically that speech while showing stats on carousels. It's part of it. Oh, so when I begin a client kickoff, one of the early things we do is what I call a UX primer, and I walk people through a bunch of just stuff that people need to know when they're approaching a responsive user experience redesign for the web. And one of the things is carousels. I hit it every time. It's real short. I don't get too belabored, but I do point out that it's dumb.
Yeah.
And it's good to do that early before people start suggesting carousels. That's the trick. Once they suggest a carousel, then they need to sort of defend themselves a bit, like it's an ego problem then. They feel bad, right? Mm-hmm. So either they feel bad that they suggested the dumb thing, or they get defensive because they don't want it to be a dumb thing they suggested. So it's good to get that just preemptively. Let them know we're not going to be suggesting carousels today.
Nice. Yeah, it's going to become like the IE rally cry.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. There's a progressive enhancement thing in there. You don't have to have rounded corners on all your buttons in old IE. It's fine.
Yeah, it'll be okay.
No one's using the latest version of Chrome on one computer and then like IE6 on another computer. That's not a real user. It's fine. Progressive enhancement's good.
Yep, definitely.
Bunch of things like that. It's fun.
Yeah, so this next question is kind of a fun one, Matt, and I always caveat it because I know you didn't get where you are on your own, and you lauded your team, and rightly so, about how great your team has been, and I'm sure that you would say that they upheld you as much as you upheld them during these last 7-plus years. It's been almost 8 years, 8 or 9 years, actually, been doing this.
I think 8.5 now.
8.5 years, yeah. So I want to ask you, though, you've certainly achieved a level of success in our field, and I want to ask you, what would your UX superhero name be, Matt?
Oh, boy. I'm going to go with Decision Or, because I have no problem making decisions about things.
Nice.
Saying, let's just do A or B. Whatever it is, right? Let's just try that thing. That sounds good enough. If we're unclear, let's test it and find out if we were right or not and like move on. But let's not debate this endlessly. I'm a big fan of decidering.
That's good, man. I like that. Decision Or.
That's a terrible name, but it's a good point to it, I think.
Hopefully. Yeah. No, I like that. And again, it speaks to your leadership. And I know that's what you're going to be doing over at Shopify too, is you're going to be leading a team. And so to me, I really like that answer, Matt. And I think it really suits you because that's one of the hardest things about leadership, especially being newer to a leadership role, is you always want to like make sure you're making the right decision.
But you won't know that.
You don't know that until you make the decision, right?
The worst decision is no decision most of the time. I mean, you gather information. You don't just like sit around going, that one, this one, that one. Like, I don't want to sound like that. But like, you listen to your team and gather the facts and draw on your own experience and then make the best guess you can and then be open to being wrong and changing it. It's fine.
I love it. You may have answered this possibly when I asked you what your design superpower was, because I just thought that was such a great answer. But maybe you got something else up your sleeve here. But I want to ask you, what one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users?
Oh, boy. I think it's usually when I'm interacting with stakeholders, those internal folks in our group a little bit, but mostly with stakeholders and organizations we're working with, where we try to just get away from opinions or hunches and get towards real user desires and tasks and making those overlap with the needs of the organization wherever possible. And then confirming those theories with testing and just getting people away from their own investments or the like. My uncle's a painter and he doesn't like that color blue, right? Like that's no thanks. Not that opinion isn't welcome here. We're going to start thinking instead about how to make your users happy so that you look good.
That's good.
Hey.
Good stuff.
I mean, what's interesting, I mean, I think people complain about client stuff all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I used to complain about it a lot too. until I realized that's not their job. They have a different job. That's not what we do. Surprise.
Right.
They're hired to do something at their organization too, much like we are. And it has nothing to do with the stuff we do. They don't know how to talk about it. They don't know what it is. Like for some short period of time, they're charged with making sure the website thing goes okay, right? Whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And they don't know what the hell they're doing. So the best thing you can do is make them look good by educating them when it's appropriate, but not overburdening them, because again, they have a whole other job they have to do, and working with them and supporting them so that they know that you're hearing them, you're getting their feedback, which is important, you're getting their perspective, which is important, their understanding about the industry that you know nothing about, probably. So you get all that information from them and then take all of your expertise to help make the best decisions for them and yourself. They're not trying to screw you up. They're not like, man, I can't wait to launch this crappy thing. I'll have really come through for everyone if I just really just turn a screw in this, just put a big old turd on top of it as much as I can. No one's doing that. Nobody's like, how do I make Matt's life horrible, right? Yeah. His product's poopy. That's not a thing. They just don't know. So being empathetic to that and trying to help take their hand and sort of walk them through this process and this thing that they don't know much about and are probably pretty apprehensive about because they don't know what they're doing and their job's probably on the line in some way or another, and making that easier for them and making it easy for them to be successful. And when you do that, those people can't wait to hire you again. Which is a nice outcome for us, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I love that too, like making them look good. I mean, that's what they're paying us for, right? Set, making them look good and making things work.
Yeah, they don't care if Bearded looks good. And I shouldn't either, particularly. I mean, I do, but I do that by way of making them look good, right?
Yes.
And I think that's how you get your next job. That's how you get your next client and your next project, is by doing exactly that. I mean, if you fight them and fight them and fight them and they hate you the whole time. I used to work with a guy that said something like, it doesn't matter if they hate us now, because when we're done, the project's going to be so great that they're going to forget all about that because everyone's going to tell them how wonderful it is. And I thought, that is utter shit. That is absolutely not true. People remember the bad human interactions they had way more than they like some design you did that won't matter to them in a few years. But 8 years from now, they're going to be laying in bed and going, man, that guy was an asshole. You know, like that, that's going to stay with them.
So it's true. We do remember. We do remember that, especially negative things that are said. We remember that way more than any positive things. It outshadows it.
You remember that horrible fight we had about that project? Like, that's the thing you remember. Not.
Yeah.
You may not even remember what the project looked like, but that fight will stick with you a long time.
Yeah, I agree. So I think it's sort of the tightrope act sometimes of being truthful about what you see as a design professional, right? Yeah. So it kind of be a harbinger, if you will. Like, hey, we can do that, but this is something you need to know, right? Like being able to kind of explain that with humility and not with like a forceful hand of like, hey, I'm the professional. You need to just do what I say.
Just listen to me. I'm the designer. Who's the designer here? Like that kind of crap. It's just so
exactly.
Like, man, get secure with yourself. It's going to be okay. Like you are the designer. We all know you're the designer. Settle the F down a little bit. It doesn't really mean that much, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's, you come in there and say like, hey, let's hang on back up for a second and talk about the project goals. What are we actually trying to accomplish?
Right.
And you can probably apply that to every situation, no matter how large or small. I want to change that button color. Let's talk about how that does or does not support the project goals.
Right? Yes.
I think that should be a brighter red. Okay. What does that do? Probably attracts more attention to that thing. Is that something we want to attract attention toward? And also, do we want to detract attention from everything else on the page? Is that what we're trying to do? If it is, yes, let's make that thing brighter red. If not, maybe we shouldn't do that.
Yeah. And what does this do with design patterns, right? Like, does this look like an error, right?
Yes. How does that affect that? Man, I've gotten into such a thing one time over with branding folks that insisted that every button was red. And I kept telling them, we're building an application. You can't make the save button red. We just can't do that.
Oh, man.
And like, let's talk about basic human color associations. And I came up with a whole demonstration of it using actually their existing website, their donation form, which I thought was very problematic. Hmm. And it was a bunch of binary states, like on, off, yes, no states, right? Using red active states. And you could not tell which one was which.
Oh, no.
And then I redid it using green and showed it to them. And I redid it using one of their other brand colors, which was yellow, which is a more neutral. And we mm-hmm. walked through it, and I was like, tell me which one's active. And they honestly, they didn't know that. Luckily they were high enough that they didn't know the form well enough that they knew which one was supposed to be active, and they couldn't figure it out. They were honest. They were like, God, I have no idea. And I said, that's how your users feel. They don't know what's going on here. And you're in fact pushing them towards the wrong answer, using red as a positive color. People do not see it that way. Red is fire. Red is blood. You cannot beat that. Red is stop signs. You cannot beat that.
Yeah.
I don't care what's in your brand manual. Let's think of another way to do this. And it worked.
Wow. That's an awesome story, Matt.
Oh, thanks. I'd forgotten about that one, too.
I love that. That's a good...
If red's in your logo, don't make it a default button color, let me tell you.
Yeah.
It's not in an application where you have things like save and cancel.
Right.
Oh, saves red, cancels gray. Nope. No.
Yep. Yep. That's really good. That's some good takeaways right there, defenders. Always be willing to challenge lovingly, of course. Be willing to challenge assumptions, especially from your clients, but do it in a tactful way. Because unfortunately, as we were just touching on, the design industry has unfortunately gotten a little bit tarnished by the former, by just saying, I'm the designer and you need to listen to me, and that'll be $20,000.
That's never a good argument. I'm the designer is never a good argument.
No, never. It's an insecure statement. It's a statement of insecurity.
If you're the designer, prove it. Show me what you're trying to do. You can't just say, because I'm the designer. No, wrong.
Yeah.
And likewise, in my example, if I just said red can't be that color, that's bad. That's not a good convincing argument. And even explaining the abstract is still one step removed from something useful. To say red is a negative connotation color, we can't use it for a save button.
Yeah.
But to go, it took me 15 minutes to put together a quick demonstration. I got in the browser, I changed some colors in the inspector and took screenshots, right? Mm-hmm. And then it was like, here it is green, here it is red, here it is yellow, you tell me. We did our own little usability test.
Mm-hmm.
And that did it, because once you use a practical example, it directly communicates the thing. It's not this like, let me think about that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You experience it and then you know.
Oh, man, I love it. So I was just thinking about as designers, I mean, we're kind of journalists in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's kind of like, I think it's one of these newspapers. I think it's like the Chicago Tribune or one of these really big newspapers out there that has the... I saw this movie called The Case for Christ. It was very interesting. Mm-hmm. It was about a journalist who was a former atheist, and he went out to dispel the resurrection of Christ. It was very interesting. He's a journalist, and he took... And anyway, there's some scenes from the office. I think it's the Chicago Tribune. And there's this big banner hanging up in the office, these journalists. It says, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. It's kind of like, you know what? It's like
amazing,
right? Isn't that great? It's amazing. Like, yeah, she says she loves you, but what? Show some proof. Let's see
but
some evidence.
Does she really, mom?
Bring the facts. Bring the facts out. But I just love that, because I think as designers, we really kind of need to sort of approach our projects in the same way, right? It's not my opinion is better than yours, or my experience matters more than yours. It's like, let's examine the facts. Let's determine the problems. Let's figure out who the users are, and let's solve this together. And I'm going to use my experience to help do that. And I'm going to work with you alongside you to help, you know, unearth those facts and dispel the assumptions.
And sometimes we do those exercises and I'm wrong, and that's great.
Right.
That means we're doing it right. Right. If I was always right, then it would clearly be bullshit that I was just pushing for my own ideas and good at arguing, which maybe I am. But sometimes I need to lose those arguments.
Yeah.
If the facts point the other way, then that's the way we go.
Yeah.
You know, I may come in there saying, I hate carousels, but every once in a while, carousel may be the right solution.
That's true. And I admire your humility, Matt, and being willing to admit that. You know what? There may be a case, there may be a project, there may be an audience, or maybe a business model.
There's totally a case. I'll give you a case for a carousel. You want to do
it? The case for carousel.
Okay. If you're talking about multiple similar features of the same product, for instance, an iPhone, go for it. Have your carousel. You know, because even if you skip the other slides, you're just not missing the iPhone. It's still an iPhone. But if you're interested enough to see all of it, then maybe you see that it has like a sweet camera and a sweet microphone and whatever iPhones have. That maybe is reasonable. Certainly more reasonable than four totally unrelated things in a carousel.
Yes, that's a good point.
The thing that I would caution with there, though, is that you still have that performance issue. So if you're going to put things in that carousel, don't pretend that it's one image. No, you put four images in there and really do what you can to save people the download, right?
Yeah, I like that perspective a lot, Matt, because you can at least, you can know that if they've gotten to the content they're looking for and you present them a carousel, at least you know that's what they were actually looking for, right?
Yeah.
It's actually relevant to what they want.
Totally.
I love that. Awesome. There's a lot of good takeaways on carousels in this episode too, Matt.
Life
which is
itself
good.
Is a bit of a carousel.
It really is. It is. Let's we can dive deep on that one.
Let's not.
But we don't have the time, so let's wrap up the show. Let's wrap up the show with the imparting of superpowers. What's one habit you believe contributes to your success?
Oh boy, I'd say, caring about doing good work, because frustrating experiences just feel bad, and so you know I want less of them in the world. So I think just making a habit out of giving a shit about people I've never met and will never meet and trying to feel their pain and their frustration and alleviate it before it happens. That's my superpower.
That's good.
We can all have that one, right?
Yeah. And I think that's one that should be contagious. I think we should evangelize that superpower. I mean, it's all about truly caring about what you do and the people you're doing it for.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you're making some websites just because you think websites look cool and you like being the person that made cool looking websites, I don't know if you're in the right business.
Yeah, or time era.
Yeah, right.
That's how it was when I started, man. And it was fun. Yeah. It was super fun. Flash was a blast. It was like a playground.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But there was more like, you just because you can doesn't mean you should. There was a lot of that.
Pushing the boundaries is important, right? Like we got to...
Yeah.
Do that stuff. But ultimately, if you want to be an artist, go be an artist. But that's not what a designer is. I had a professor tell me that something similar in a class once. She was always so nice. Her name was Jenny Elshami, and she was always so just friendly and like bubbly and happy. And then one of the students said that they felt one of the other students was really starting to develop a style because they had some consistent work. And that was the first time I saw Jenny get mad. And she was like, "You don't have a style. You're not an artist. You're a designer. Your style is whatever is appropriate for the project." And I thought, right on, Jenny. That is
dang,
so true.
Mic drop.
Yeah, right? Your style is whatever is appropriate for the project. Right on.
Oh, that's good. I love it. Matt, what's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
I'm going to go with hands on that one.
Hands?
You can draw, you can point, you can move things around, you can pat people on the back, you can high-five them. They're the best. I still like hands. And after that, I'd say like prototyping in the browser. I think that doing beats explaining most days. If you can just put it in the browser, get it on a phone, get it on a computer, see how it works, then you have something to talk about. I'm into that.
Awesome. Hands. That's good.
Love
that's
hands.
The first time I've heard that.
Has hands.
That's good. Hands are great. I'm thankful for hands.
Yeah, me too. I mean, yeah. And of course, obviously, if you have hand-related disabilities there, you know, that does not exclude you from being a designer, I'm sure.
That's right.
There's still lots of wonderful things to do.
That's absolutely true.
And then please talk to me and tell me all the ways I'm wrong. My ears are open.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, Matt, because not everybody has them. Either by birth or through an accident
just articulation, right? Like having motor skill disabilities are quite common, right?
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. And I think it's another case for empathy too, right there.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm an idiot all the time, just so you know, by the way, Jason.
Me too.
I'm right. the ways in which I do not know how the world works are effectively infinite. So if your experiences contradict mine, I am quite happy to hear about them.
Yeah. And I like that. I think that's what makes us designers, right? And I mean, if the world was, in fact, this kind of reminds me of an interview I did it was a while ago, but it was with Alexa Lee Herasimchuk. And I said, you know, what's your design kryptonite? And then her answer was really fascinating. She said utopia, because if everything was perfect, there would be no need for us.
Mm. Yeah. Oh yeah. Luckily the
Isn't
world,
that
everything's,
interesting?
Everything's terrible.
Everything's awful here.
Yeah. It's great.
I
had that discussion with a colleague recently when I was explaining why I was so down on a certain term used in website navigation. I think it was explore or discover. I hate both of them. But I explained why I hate both of them, mostly because they're meaningless and don't tell you what you're going to get when you click on the thing. And also because it makes a really false assumption that people just can't wait to just dig around and play in other organizations' sandboxes when they never want that. They just want to find the thing they want and get the hell out of there. And that's great. And you should work towards that, not away from it. Anyhow,
yes,
after that explanation, he said, "Wow, you hate everything." And I immediately responded, "That's only because everything's terrible." But
everything sucks.
But that's great because we're designers and that's our jobs to fix terrible things. And that's everything. It's so great. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
There's no end to our work.
That is so true. And there's always a new problem, something new cropping up every day.
Oh, yeah. We can't even keep up with all the terrible. It's even the things we make good get terrible again before too long. So it's just the best. I love it.
So maybe the title of this episode should be Everything's Terrible and I Love It.
Everything's Terrible and
with I love Matt it. Griffin.
I'm all for that.
Okay.
That's accurate.
I think it could pique some, I think it could, inspire some additional downloads.
Is that too clickbaity?
Maybe, but that's okay. As long as somebody could hear this content.
It's not, at least it's not like five great ways to keep everything from being terrible. As long as you don't do that, because I can't promise that. It's going to still be terrible.
Oh, no matter what. So good.
Hi, I'm Femke, and I'm a designer, writer, and podcaster, and I fight for the users. You're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
So I love reading, and a lot of our defenders listening do it. They do as well. So I'm sure you do too, Matt. You have a lot of wisdom.
Oh, I can't read, but I would like to someday.
You know, there are some people who can't read. It's true.
No, this is true. But I was accused, actually, of not reading at all in my office, jokingly, because people talk about books and it just routinely ignore me in the conversation. And finally, one day, I was like, guys, you know, I'm reading books, too. And they really dug into me for that one and never let it go. So Griffin can't read is definitely a thing that's said around my office.
Well, speaking of clickbait, so maybe you can't read, but guess what? Try my Audible's trial subscription by going to... I've partnered with Audible, and I'm glad you asked. No.
Have you really?
I have.
He'll do it. Do the pitch.
Okay. So we love audio, and you're listening to audio right now, and it's a great way, I think, a great way to consume content, a great way to let it connect to your heart before it connects to your head. But I have teamed up with Audible, and if you go to, it's userdefenders.com/freebook. You can try Audible for free, and they'll give you a free book, and it's pretty cool. So it's a great way to consume content without necessarily having to try to flip through pages and try to decipher bad typography.
That was fantastic.
That's the end. How was that?
I think you knocked it out of the park.
Oh, yes. So thanks, Matt. Thanks for indulging me. And I don't know
that
whether or not that makes the cut. We'll see.
I love it. Do it.
Okay. All right. So if you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why?
I'm going to recommend more than one book, but I'll try to do it fast.
Okay. No problem.
I'm into literary fiction. According to a study I think Google did, it increases our ability for empathy, probably because you have to inhabit the mind of another person. So the last three books that I read Natural Histories by Guadalupe Nettle, which are a series of short stories. I like her a lot. Then I read, I think it's a bestseller, but Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Oh, wow.
Americana. It's a great, great novel about the experience of an African immigrant to the U.S. and the perspective that that brings. And it was fascinating to see myself from the outside. I learned a lot. And I also read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, which was also excellent. That's not fiction, but great. Before that, Infinite Jest, David Foster Wallace, I finally read the whole damn thing. And it was amazing. I definitely, if you're interested at all in mood disorders and depression, anxiety, things like that, as well as substance abuse problems in a totally wild, epic, gigantic, fictional world. It is, it's for you, let me tell you. Happy stuff.
Wow.
All the happy things. It's great. I mean, I found all those books to be life-changing in some smaller or moderate way.
Have those been kind of nice respites for how awful the world can be?
I mean, a lot of them are about how awful the world is. So I guess no, but yes, in that it's not happening to me. I'm just get to observe from the outside. But I mean, I'd like, I mean, I like sad stuff. I like sad bastard music. I like, I like sad books.
What's that mean?
I don't know. Sad things are pretty. I think sad things are beautiful a lot of the time. So I'm a weirdo, but, I don't know, because, you know, life is tragic. Life is difficult and hard and painful, even for in the easiest of circumstances. It's really hard to exist in the world, I think. And to be a person who is sensitive to the world around you and empathetic to the world around you is very, very painful a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So getting experiences and evidence that we are not alone in that pain is really, really valuable. And seeing the diversity of those experiences and sometimes painful, sometimes joyful experiences, I think is great. It's like, I think I found my first music in high school that was like music that expressed the pain of existence in one form or another. And I was so happy because I felt like, oh, I'm not alone. Other people feel this way too. And it's okay to express it in some way. I'm into sad stuff. It's great.
Well, speaking of sad bastard music, what's it like in Tom York's head, do you think?
I think it's pretty sad. I mean, lately he's had a really rough time, you know, like that was, Moonshaped Pool was sad enough when it was a divorce record, but his wife died not long after that from cancer.
That.
Yeah, no, so it's
Yeah,
so I think he's sad anyway.
Dang, he was already sad before that.
Yeah, and then like epically sad things happen. So, I mean, I don't know, does like being already sad in general, like prepare you for the shit that's going to happen. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe you're like, yeah, of course this is happening. This is what I thought was going to happen the whole time.
Yeah. Don't ask how much worse could it get.
Right.
Don't ask that question because it could get worse.
Turns out lots of bad things can happen, but yeah, so that's great. But I love that record. The Moonshaped Pool is fantastic. And I think partly Tom York and I share, I would guess from his, if his lyrics hold any water at all, then we share some anxiety issues and like maybe some mood disorder stuff. So it's like, it's definitely like, I don't feel alone kind of music for me.
Oh man. Yeah. It's funny. I actually share some of those feelings as well.
It's not uncommon.
Some of those challenges.
I think people are often afraid to talk about it, but I think, anxiety, depression, bipolar, all of that stuff, the whole mood disorder, fun bag.
Oh yeah. fun bag.
are pretty common in creative industries, and development and software and all that stuff. I'm pretty upfront about it myself.
Yeah.
And when I mention it to people, it's pretty often that they reciprocate something.
Yeah.
And
I believe it.
I think it's fine. You know, we'll all get through it.
I think it's healthy.
Oh, it's good to talk about it. I mean, it hurts a lot, but I luckily don't have anything super severe or horrible. I've been able to work through it for the most part. Now I'm trying medication, which has really helped a lot, and I wish I had done earlier. So if you were in that zone and considering medication, I say talk to a psychiatrist, not a PCP, someone who specializes in matching medication with people, and give it a shot because, you know, it might get better, which is pretty cool. But yeah, I think, you know, we should just take away the stigma and talk about it. It's fine.
Yeah, totally.
Well, our brains are messy and terrible blobs of chemicals and biology anyway. Like, there's nothing to be embarrassed about there.
Yeah. No, you know what? We need each other. And I think that's one of the things that's so neat about this community, Matt. And I know you'd be the first to jump in and talk about how incredible, and we could actually probably spend an entire episode talking about how incredible this industry is and the people. That's the people in
they made me make
that
a
make it that way.
Without even knowing who I was or what I was going to do in the editing room. They're either very foolish or very open. Maybe both.
No, and I love that you said that. And defenders listening, check out What Comes Next as a Future. It's so inspiring. It's a beautiful piece of work.
Oh,
it's beautifully done and tastefully done. And I know you put so much, you and the team put so much into it, especially you. I know that this was a huge labor of love for you.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to highly recommend it. It's going to be in the show notes.
But one of my favorite things that came afterwards, I didn't let anybody see any of it until the week of the premiere when it was almost finished, which is I know, what is my problem, right? Like that's crazy. But I finally let one of my colleagues watch it, who was one of the least technical people I worked with. And she watched and she said one of the biggest impressions she came away with is the people who build the web are just good people who are trying to do good things. And that was it was so nice to see, because you see so much bad stuff in the news about the internet's destroying whatever, and trolls and comments and all the horrible parts of the internet make a lot of news. But like the people building it aren't doing it for that. They're not like, how can I make people feel shit in YouTube comments? Like, no one's doing that. They're like, how do I make the world a better place? You know? And that's nice to see that.
Oh, fully agree, Matt. Well, unlike a Radiohead song, I'm going to end this on an up note.
Oh, good.
Yes. What's your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes? And you've given a lot already, Matt, but do you have anything else you want to leave us with?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is maybe the wrong answer for this show, Jason, I'm going to do it anyway. My advice is to just not be a superhero. I feel like the superhero is really popular always, but especially during times of crisis, and that definitely means right now. And I think that there's this wishful thinking that this one special person's going to come along and fix everything for us, and that's just not how it works. There's no Superman. He's not going to come and save us. There's no Wonder Woman, as nice as that might be. They're not going to fix everything. It's just regular flawed people with regular abilities and capabilities and knowledge and limited thinking and limited experience, and they're going to have to fix it. That's us. You know, we're going to have to do it. So I think we don't need to try to be superheroes. We just need to be people trying our best. I tell myself a lot to do my best each day and no more than that. You don't beat yourself up for your shortcomings. You just try to get a little bit better every day from what you learned the day before. One of my professors in school, Paul Brown, who was like, I think of as my graphic design dad, he gave me good advice over the years. And he said, when I was being frustrated on a project, you know, every project, you should try to pick something that you can take away from it, that you can learn from it. And if you can do that, you'll have a long and very satisfying career. And if you can't, you're going to be very frustrated a lot of the time. So I think if you can do something like that, you're going to keep improving all the time. Your efforts will be valuable. Your time will be well spent. And eventually you'll look up from what you're doing and find that you're not so bad at what you do as you were when you started. And that's kind of a nice feeling.
That's good, man. I just appreciate your vulnerability, Matt, and your transparency.
Oh, hey, thanks.
And the superhero thing, I appreciate that response too. I think that certainly, superheroes, the concept in general can be a little fluffed up, a little more than it needs to be. And certainly,
it's a seductive idea. I mean, I think it's something that speaks to the heart of us as people, is like, not only do we want to be special, but we want someone else. So we want to see people that are better, right? And we want to see problems fixed. We want to live in a just world where justice is done. We all want that. And it's so frustrating to live in a world where that is not happening most of the time.
Well, if there ever was a time that we need superheroes, it certainly is now.
Oh, man, it would be great, wouldn't it? Like, I think people love that because it's, God, it would be great.
Well, you know what I love too is just, and this is the last thing I'll say on this, but I think that part of it is that, you know, we had the original Batman and the original Superman, and it was almost just like, you know, a dude in pajamas, right? A dude. I mean, it was just everything felt so staged. And I just want to say, you know, because this whole show, it is superhero themed, and the reason that I think this is a good time to mention that it's not like the whole Batman and Superman pajama thing of getting the glory, and it's really, and that's why I think I like a lot of these modern movies a lot more, is because they really dive into, these people have superpowers, but you know what? They're also struggling a lot, and here's their struggles. Here's like even the Logan movie. I don't know if you saw the Logan movie
but really good.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's like Tom York could have done the soundtrack to that movie. But I mean, it's raw, and it just shows you in a deeper way than the comic book, the pages could show you. I think the struggles and the personal struggles and the personal challenges, but yet there's still that desire. And I have this written down in my notes here. And I always have it in front of me every interview I conduct. And it's kind of the definition of a superhero. And I really like this, and I want to kind of close with this, but you know, superheroes typically possess a strong moral code, including a willingness to risk one's own safety in the service of good without expectation of reward.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good, right?
I can get behind that.
There we go. So I thank you, Matt, for being a superhero. Whether you accept that title or not, you are and you have been. And
I'll accept that definition. I think I do my best at doing that when I can.
I think you do. And this whole interview has shown that.
You risk failure for the greater good, right?
Yeah, this has been incredible, Matt. I just want to thank you for what you've done, what you continue to do. I can't wait to see what you're going to do over at Shopify. And I just want to also say, fight on, my friend.
Oh, thanks, Jason. That's really nice. Thanks, you too. It's been great getting to talk with you and have this whole chat. So thanks a lot.
You can tell Matt has been at this for a long time. So many great takeaways, including the importance of being bold enough to make decisions as a leader and then figure out if you were wrong after, and never ever saying, because I'm the designer. I also love talking about taking on the role of a journalist before and during any project, and by God, Tom York needs a hug. I hope you enjoyed this one and got a ton of value from it, Defenders. I know I did. I want to draw your attention to the Biweekly Bugle. If you wouldn't mind checking it out, I'd love to be able to connect and engage with you on a more personal level. I know that a lot of these conversations are one way, but I certainly would love to have you on the Biweekly Bugle, where I share super guest announcements, I write a little usable thought, and just kind of tell you what's going on in my life and my world. So love to do that. And also, I'm on the other side of the reply button. So you can do that at userdefenders.com/join. I want to thank Adobe for sponsoring this episode. I also want to thank Chris Combs for the extraordinary editing and Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork. In 2 weeks, I have wonderful web designer / studio manager / author of Practical Design Discovery, Dan Brown. This was a really fun one too, and a lot of value in it. So be sure to tune in, and you can subscribe by going to userdefenders.com/subscribe so you don't miss it. And until next time, fight on, my friends.